Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is now episode number 649. My name is Camden Busey. I'm here in Grays Lake, Illinois. And as usual, I'm delighted to be back with a good group of people, a wonderful panel to discuss an important book. So let me introduce to you first my colleague, the president of the board here at Reformed Forum, and more significantly, a pastor of South Austin OPC in South Austin, Texas, Jim Cassidy. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to see you today.
Hey, Camden. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well.
On this Memorial Day.
It is.
Happy Memorial Day.
Recording on Memorial Day, and very thankful for that. Looking forward to having a good talk and an important one at that. Today, we're actually speaking with Dr. James Anderson, who is the Carl W. McMurray Professor of Theology and Philosophy, as well as Academic Dean for Global and New York at Reformed Theological Seminary. He's been on the program before, but it's been some time, so it's wonderful to see you today. Dr. Anderson, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Looking forward to it.
Yes, we're really excited to speak with James Anderson today because we're talking about this important book, David Hume, in the Great Thinker series, of course, published by P&R Publishing. We've talked about several books in this series. I wrote one, not to toot my own horn, but I've got a special place in my heart for this series because they were kind enough to allow me to write one in the series. But there's plenty more. We're going to be doing some more interviews. We got one on Foucault lined up with Christopher Watkin, and we've talked with several other authors, so we can check those out at reformedforum.org to catch up on the books that have gone in the past. A couple things to mention before we get into the book and these important apologetic and philosophical and theological topics. Of course, we would encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org and check out some of the new things. There's some new content available on the website, and if you browse around, you can check out some new videos and online courses that we're putting out there, as well as further podcast episodes and essays. And subscribe to our newsletter, especially the print newsletter. I've been working on the contributions for that. If you'd like to get a copy of our fall newsletter, you can check out our page at reformedforum.org/newsletter. Just fill out your address, your name and address, and we'll send you a copy in the mail. In the fall, we look forward to sending that out. The next issue is going to be on the attributes of God in conjunction with our fall conference that we have planned. Lord willing, we can still have it. If not, we'll make some adjustments. I don't know if we're going to have to move venues if Illinois doesn't open up, or if it isn't wise to, or if we'll have to change dates. But you can check out all the information online, reformedforum.org. Thank you so much. Well, I got to say, I was very excited to take a look at this book. Now, I have all the books in the series on my shelf, and I'm always looking forward to speaking about them. I'm always looking forward to the new ones that are coming out because they help me to think about some important thinkers and try to situate them within a Reformed Christian worldview. So whenever we're dealing with these things, it's a polemical matter, but more significantly, one, we hope, of charity and speaking the truth in love. And I think, James, you really nailed it with this book, talking about David Hume. And in a way where there's appreciation, you're dealing with the big ideas, and he's no one to be trifled with, yet at the same time approaching him from the authority of Scripture and a specifically Reformed vantage point. So I'm very appreciative for this. Thanks for joining us today. And just let us know a little bit how you were introduced to Hume in the first place, and maybe that'll lead us into how this book came about.
Yeah, it's a good question. So how was I introduced to Hume? I think probably I was first introduced to Hume by encountering his statue on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh. As an undergraduate at Edinburgh University, I went there in the early 90s to study engineering. So had very little interest or exposure to philosophical thinking at that time. That came later, really, in my journey. So I knew of Hume as a philosopher, as a Scottish Enlightenment thinker. In fact, there's a building in the university where the philosophy department is housed, the David Hume building, obviously named after him. So he's seen as something of a hero figure in the philosophy school, I guess, at Edinburgh University. But really, it was just a name. I couldn't say that I was particularly familiar with his philosophy at that time. Mm-hmm. It was only later as I became interested in Christian apologetics, and that's a story in itself, but I won't tell that whole story. But I became interested in Christian apologetics and responding to objections, different kinds of objections to Christian claims. And you can't get very far in Christian apologetics without encountering the influence of Hume, either directly or indirectly. In fact, many of the objections I think that we encounter to the Christian faith today are Humean objections, or at least have their root in Hume's thought, even though most people don't realize it. In other words, his influence is often indirect rather than direct. So anyway, I became interested in apologetics. I became interested in philosophy. So did a lot of reading in the history of philosophy. And obviously, Hume looms large when you look at the history of Western philosophy, particularly post-Enlightenment thought. But in terms of coming to write this book, well, I'm not sure quite how that happened. I do know that the editors of this series, and Nate Shannon in particular, approached me. Asked me if I would write one of the volumes in this. I think, if I recall correctly, I was originally approached to write one on Kant, and I replied, I can't. I didn't think I was the right person to write that one. Sure. Fortunately, I've got someone better to write that volume. But I thought about it some more. I was asked, you know, is there anyone you would like to write on? And I thought, well, Hume is interesting. Because of my interest in Christian apologetics, his corpus is not too large. It's in English, so there's no translational issues there for a native English speaker. And it dovetails with other interests that I have in epistemology and Christian apologetics. So I thought, well, this would be a fun project that could slot in with some of my other interests, and maybe I could do something distinctive with the book that would go beyond the standard introductions to Hume, of which there are many excellent ones, but bring something more of a reformed and presuppositionalist approach to understanding and critiquing Hume.
Oh yeah, I think that's really one of the biggest values of this particular series, because all of these are supposed to be great thinkers. And so they already will have a fairly large and significant collection of primary sources, books that and articles that each thinker has written themselves. But then, because they're so significant, a vast array of secondary sources and other people who have written assessing the views. So that already exists. But what can be challenging is for Reformed Christians to think through things in a consistent and in a particularly Christian manner. And that's where this series, I believe, really shines when it's doing the work that the editors have laid out. And I presume you received, as well as an author, kind of the primer on their series and what, you know, objectives and formats and things that they want you to hit. And I think you did a superb job, because it not only tells you, you know, what did Hume think, but how are we to think about that and what those challenges are, and how to reform people respond, and why is a reformed approach a proper response? It's not just, you know, some activity of, well, we come from this position, so here's how we think. It's not some sort of cultural reappropriation or reader response theory sort of thing, but actually a project of truth seeking in that regard. Now, you know, I came at Hume very in a strange way. I did not take any philosophy courses in undergraduate. So my first actual philosophy course for credit was a PhD seminar when I was working on a theology PhD. I had to take external courses. So I took a class on continental philosophy. It ended up focusing on Foucault, oddly enough. But I encountered Hume through Cornelius Van Til. So as I was reading Van Til, I ended up learning kind of the Westminster Standards and, you know, post-Enlightenment philosophy, well, even all the major figures of Western philosophy backwards. So my whole training is kind of on upside down and strange. But other than Van Til, have you seen many Reformed thinkers and apologists in particular dealing with Hume directly? Or do you find it mostly with Humean-inspired arguments?
I don't think there are many Reformed writers engaging with Hume. There are plenty of Christian apologists and evangelical apologists who have written on Hume and responded particularly to his critiques of natural theology and miracle claims. But in terms of sort of sustained Reformed critiques, things are pretty thin. Even with Van Til, you get little snippets in one book and another book. And if you wanted to look at Van Til's overall critique, you might have to read half a dozen books to get the full picture. And then John Frame, of course, has his introduction to Western theology and philosophy.
Large volume.
You know, this phenomenal survey, critical survey of Western thought. And he engages with Hume there. But again, given the scope of that project, you can only devote so many pages to Hume. So really most of the Christian critiques are coming from outside the confessional reform camp.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about Hume. You mentioned, you know, his statue and whatnot. I also appreciated the fact that sometimes he wears a traffic cone, depending on the day. People, students who might not know who Hume is or have much respect for him, like to dress him up.
No respect, that's right.
Like to dress him up. But catch us up to speed and some of the listeners who might not know much about Hume in terms of his biographical details, where he was located, his dates, that sort of thing.
Yeah, so Hume was born in 1711 and lived to 1776. So he's bang in the middle of the 18th century. And he was born in Scotland. So he's Scottish born and was actually raised as a Scottish Presbyterian. His father died when he was young. He was raised by his mother. His mother, by all accounts, was a Orthodox Christian. His uncle, if I recall correctly, was actually an ordained Church of Scotland minister. So he was raised in a Scottish Presbyterian environment. He would have been familiar, no doubt, with the Westminster Standards, the Westminster Confession, although it's quite clear that early on in his life he developed a skeptical bent. There's various factors I think at play there, but he does make some comments about how he became interested in the arguments of natural theology, and on reading them, found them very disappointing. Now, to what extent that was due to a sober, rational assessment of them, or due to certain instincts or inclinations or just constitutional skepticism is another matter. But yeah, he was raised in this Presbyterian, a very Protestant environment. But as I say, early on, he indicates that for him, the doctrinal claims of the Christian faith are, if not false, not sufficiently justified. They're not rationally justified. And he becomes much more enamored with ancient Greco-Roman thought, particularly their approach to ethics over against the Christian natural law approach. And he just sort of sets himself on a trajectory away from Orthodox Christianity without ever formally, you know, announcing an apostasy. It's clearly implied in what he says. But even to his deathbed, I think he would have said that he was a Christian. But the content of that would have been very thin. It would be more in terms of a very cultural acceptance of certain moral norms. But certainly in no Orthodox sense was he a believing Christian.
How does his legacy sort of end up playing out intellectually in the context and milieu of Western thought and even down to today?
Sure. Well, I think there are many points that we can see Hume's influence in our day. And he himself was not a completely original thinker, and he would be the first to admit that there are various ideas, epistemological positions of empiricism, ideas about the source of moral beliefs that he himself has inherited and is modifying and putting into a system of thought. But then he himself, not so much in his day, but subsequently, following his death, becomes influential in a number of areas. And I go through some of these in the book. For example, notoriously, Hume influences Immanuel Kant. Immanuel Kant, the architect of the Copernican revolution in epistemology, as he himself describes it, German philosopher, who claims that he was awakened from his dogmatic slumber by reading Hume, because Kant himself had been raised or trained rather in the German rationalist tradition. So he was very happy with doing traditional metaphysics with a rationalistic bent. And Hume persuaded him basically to be an empiricist, that you couldn't do metaphysics on a rationalistic, at least not a traditional rationalistic basis. So he takes Hume's empiricism on board, but also is very troubled by Hume's skepticism, because Hume, trying to be a very consistent empiricist, ends up in a number of skeptical conclusions, which can't tolerate. And so this becomes the trigger, if you will, or at least one of the triggers for Kant's Copernican revolution. And of course, Kant's influence is massive as well, not just on Western philosophy, but on Western theology as well. You know, the Protestant liberal tradition would arguably not exist were it not for Kant and others who are influenced by him. So there's that line of influence. There's the line of influence in ethics through utilitarianism, the utilitarian approach to ethics that was pioneered by Jeremy Bentham and then John Stuart Mill, is very much inspired by Hume's approach, which is to reduce moral beliefs or moral judgments to claims about pleasure and pain. That's not quite how Hume puts it, but on the utilitarian view, an act is ethical if it brings about more pleasure than pain, or more happiness than unhappiness. But it's a naturalistic theory of ethics. That's the key. For the utilitarians, they wanted to avoid any idea of divine law or natural law. And Hume gives them some of the ingredients for a utilitarian approach to ethics, which is hugely influenced today. Many of the moral beliefs and positions that people take today, whether they recognize it or not, are motivated by basically utilitarian thinking in ethics. We could talk about the logical positivist movement, which came in the mid-20th century and then went away again, collapsed under its own internal contradictions. But what we might call the scientistic approach today, or scientism being the view that true knowledge has to be scientifically justified knowledge, or true knowledge has to be founded on the scientific method of empirical observation and rational deduction. Again, that's a very Humean position, and many people who hold to scientism maybe wouldn't attribute it directly to Hume, but undoubtedly there's a Humean influence there. So we see it in a number of areas, but many of the skeptical positions that people take today, many of the secular philosophies, secular approaches to ethics, secular epistemologies, owe a lot to Hume. If not entirely, he certainly has to be given a lot of credit.
And particularly, maybe you indicated this already, but this just a quick follow-up. Hume isn't sort of excluding the influence, if I could put it that way, of the supernatural upon the natural or upon our own understanding. He's not doing that sort of driven by atheistic convictions as we would understand atheism today, right? Or is he? Is it that he's influenced by and motivated by an atheistic agenda, or is it that atheism comes along later and sort of picks up his thought as a justification for their own unbelief?
Hume is certainly not a militant atheist, such as you would find today, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris, Christopher Hitchens, these new atheists, even though many of them would want to recruit Hume for their cause and would use a lot of sort of reheated Humean arguments. Hume himself was, so I argue in the book, not an atheist, because that would commit him to too much. atheism, if atheism is the denial of the existence of God, that's a metaphysical claim. And Hume doesn't think that you can rationally justify any metaphysical claims, whether it's the claim that God does exist or the claim that God doesn't exist. So Hume is better described as an agnostic, someone who's not going to commit himself regarding certainly the existence of God as classically understood, an all-powerful, all-good, transcendent creator of the universe. In some of his writings, he does show sympathies for deism or something close to deism. It's hard to pin him down, but he does say that really everyone can clearly see that there's some sort of intelligent agency behind the universe. He's not exactly an intelligent design advocate, but he acknowledges that there is some sort of design or order. But his argument is that you don't need theism. You don't need classical theism to explain that kind of order. But nor is he a champion of atheism either. He's a champion of skepticism about any religious claims for or against. Now, what motivates that? Well, that's more of a psychological question, and you know, I try not to get into psychoanalysis of Hume in the book, although, you know, we as Reformed Christians know that there is an underlying spiritual issue, suppression of the knowledge of God. And Hume, like any unbeliever, wants to escape the force of natural revelation. He wants to find ways to really to assert his autonomy. And that's something I discuss in the book, that Hume really at the start of his project assumes an autonomous stance with respect to human knowledge and human ethics. And he really wants to explain all of human experience without reference to God, without reference to the supernatural. It's not that he starts with some neutral position and then concludes that supernaturalism is false, but really he starts with a methodological naturalism, follows it through, and of course ends up with naturalistic theories of ethics, of religion, of everything else. But it all goes back to that initial starting point. He's not a neutral observer. He's not a neutral thinker. Of course, none of us are.
Yeah, it's interesting. We can't get into psychologizing Hume, but there is indication also that he even struggled to live out his philosophical thoughts. I mean, he recognized the tension between the conclusions of his philosophical, you know, project and how he lived in the world, and it just kind of at the end of the day just had to put aside his philosophy just to exist.
And he makes some extremely candid, revealing comments in his philosophical works. There's some stuff in his he did a sort of brief autobiography of a summary of his life, but even in his philosophical works, he speaks quite personally about how when he follows through the implications of his philosophy, it leads him to certain skeptical, very radical, troubling skeptical conclusions about what he actually knows. He finds it disturbing, and he says, well, basically, I have to leave my study, and I go find my friends, have a drink, play some backgammon, and everything seems normal again. All of my beliefs, my common sense beliefs, are sort of still in place. I don't worry about it. And he's in this tension between Hume the philosopher and Hume the ordinary human being who has to live in the world along with the rest of us.
Right, yeah. I mean, with his views on causality, I don't even know why you would even play backgammon or billiards or something. Like, what's the point? Yeah.
Well,
I'm not doing this anyway.
See, that's his whole theory of causation. It's just custom.
Yeah.
And I guess it was his habit to play backgammon.
It's the habit. Well, let's zoom out a little bit. This has been fascinating and should set the table, I think, for the rest of our conversation as we more or less dive down into some different areas of Hume's thought with greater specificity. But to begin on the details of Hume's project, what was really his central focus in all of his philosophical writings? What do you think tied them together to see that he was working on something grand, really?
Fortunately, Hume is one of these thinkers who tells you up front, this is what I'm trying to do. There's nothing trying to be sort of snuck in the back door. He's quite explicit about what his project is and what are the principles on which he is going to pursue this project. And his project is, in his own words, a complete science of human nature, a complete science of human nature. Basically, what Hume wanted to do was to do for human nature what Isaac Newton had done for non-human nature. That is, Isaac Newton had come up with governing laws or principles that described the operation of the planetary motions and, you know, physical objects out there in the world. And Hume sees human beings as part of nature. As I say, he's sort of a default naturalist, and he thinks, well, everything about us must be part of the natural world. So that means that human beliefs, human desires, human motivations, human experiences must all have natural explanations in the same way that the motion of the planets or water flowing down a hill, these all have natural explanations. So he wants to produce a science, a scientific, as he understands scientific, analysis of human nature, of which is mainly human beliefs and experiences and human actions, choices that we make, particularly the moral choices that we make. So that's his project, to try and come up with some basic governing principles that will allow you to describe human nature and human activity. And he's going to proceed on the basis of two guiding principles. One is empiricism, that every claim that he makes has to be grounded in experience. And he says this quite explicitly in the introductions to his works, that he doesn't want to reach any conclusions that go beyond experience, beyond what can be justified on the basis of immediate experience. Sensory observations. Now he can add reason to that. So if you observe something and you can deduce something from that observation, then experience and reason can be used in that way. But the source of all the information has to come through empirical observation. So empiricism is one guiding principle. And the other is, as I said earlier, methodological naturalism, that every explanation has to be in something like a scientific natural law of cause and effect, or some regularity, some principle of regularity that will explain why humans believe what they do and why humans act as they do. So that's sort of the project, yeah. And the governing principles that are going to constrain the way he explores it and the conclusions that he reaches.
And it seems then that approach would also then lead him to skepticism about things that can't be explored in those ways.
Exactly. So anything that cannot be justified on the basis of reason, fairly narrowly understood, and experience is not rationally justified. It can't count as knowledge, and you have to take a skeptical stance with it, which for Hume doesn't mean that you have to doubt it. He doesn't take the view that if you can't rationally justify something, then you have to doubt it, you have to disbelieve it, because he actually thinks that we're constitutionally incapable of not believing certain things. There are certain things that we have to believe, but it's in our nature to believe them. It's not because we can rationally justify those beliefs.
So those would be sort of, to use maybe Plantinga's terms, properly basic beliefs. Is that what he's saying? Like, or an inherent intuitive belief?
Yeah, they're basic beliefs in the sense that they're things that we just believe constitutionally. It's just in our nature to believe them. So, for example, to believe that there really is a world out there that exists independent of all my experiences of it. So if I have an experience of a tree, Hume says you have the experience, but what you can't prove is that there is this independently existing object, a tree, that is causing your experiences. That's something you can't justify empirically. But we all believe it. Hume believes it. Everyone believes that trees are, well, I say everyone, of course. There's always
an exception.
Yeah, there's always an exception, especially in philosophy.
Right.
But, the, you know, ordinary people, and Hume wants to, you know, be an ordinary person with ordinary beliefs. And so you believe that there's a tree, you believe that there are all these other things, but that's it's part of our nature to have that belief. It's not rationally justified. So for Hume, if we're going to use that terminology of that sort of Plantingan terminology of basic beliefs, we have a bunch of basic beliefs, but I think he would balk at saying they are properly basic beliefs, because certainly as Plantinger uses that term, a properly basic belief is one that is rationally justified, or minimally we're within our epistemic rights to hold it. It has some sort of well grounded in some way. Plantinger wouldn't say that all of our basic beliefs are properly basic beliefs. But for Hume, he wouldn't even go that far. Either you have a belief that can be rationally justified on the basis of observation and things that we can infer from observation, or it's just a habitual or customary or naturally occurring belief, but it wouldn't count as knowledge.
Now, there's an interesting kind of philosophical historical point here too, and Americans would probably be interested in this when we speak about Scottish common sense realism, because that's dealing with a lot of these ideas. And if I'm not mistaken, Plantinga kind of picks up and modernizes, or you know, runs that through a more analytic philosophy mindset and develops it. But Hume, being a Scot, dealing with these various approaches that we find in maybe Hutcheson or Thomas Reed, and a lot of the early documents of the founding of the United States of America, it's been recognized or largely influenced by some of these thoughts. But Hume is coming at it from a different perspective, or more skeptical position. So, you know, I mean, is Hume actively working, you know, against some of these ideas in his native homeland, or was he just kind of operating as an independent thinker and just coming to his conclusions as he saw fit?
I think he fancied himself as an independent thinker. You know, for all the criticisms that we might make of Hume and the counterintuitive conclusions that he reaches, what you have to credit him with is an attempt to be rigorous and consistent. So he commits himself to a certain project, he commits himself to certain starting principles, and he wants to follow them through as consistently as possible. And I mean, he writes on philosophy, he writes on a bunch of other topics as well. His ambition was to be a man of letters, that is to write on every interesting topic under the sun. So he writes a history of the kings of England, or the British monarchy. He writes on politics. He writes on all kinds of themes, religious themes, and so forth. So he's someone who's engaging with the issues of the day. But underlying it all, I think, is this project to work out a rigorously naturalistic account of everything, and that's clearer in some of his writings than in others. But in terms of the milieu of his day, this is still a relatively early Enlightenment period where you know, John Locke and George Berkeley are still living memory thinkers, right? And they're pioneers of the empiricist tradition in a more contained way. Hume is arguably a more consistent empiricist than both Locke.
But also realize the incendiary nature of some of his writings. Not that he was trying to be a fiery polemicist, but he intentionally withheld some things and said, "Well, why don't you, nephew, release this after I die?"
Yeah, so Hume doesn't come out with everything that he thinks during his lifetime. So his dialogues concerning natural religion, which is a very forceful critique of natural theology, of supernaturalism, pressing the problem of evil, he reserves that for posthumous publication. But even so, even in his lifetime, it was very clear that he was a critic of orthodox Christian beliefs. He was a dangerous man. He was labeled an atheist even in his day. Really, you know, anyone who challenged orthodoxy was going to be labeled an atheist and a troublemaker. So he had that reputation even in his lifetime. But it's not as though there were two camps. There was the very orthodox Christian camp, and then there's the full out agnostic or skeptical account. Even in his day, there are lines forming. There's a spectrum of views from the very theologically conservative to early forms of theological liberalism, or what in that day was called latitudinarianism. So even John Locke, John Locke by modern accounts is very theologically conservative, but even he has actually a very thin definition of orthodoxy and veers off towards anti-Trinitarian views before his death. So there's a spectrum of views, but certainly Hume in his time is on the, maybe we should call it the left wing of this theological variation, in that he still holds to some very, very vague kind of supernaturalism, but he's certainly not willing to commit to it or to defend it. And it seems as though it doesn't have any practical relevance for him. It's sort of as if he says, well, maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't. Maybe there are a dozen gods, maybe there aren't, maybe they're all powerful, maybe they're not. But as far as living a good life goes, as far as being a good person goes, as far as practical religion goes, it really doesn't matter.
Mm. So you make the point of much of Hume's work is descriptive. For example, he's not necessarily trying to justify belief in his project or provide all the rationale to satisfy someone, kind of like a manual of how human thought works necessarily, but he's describing things rather than building a case. Is that rather intentional? And if so, for him, why did he go about things in that way?
I think it is certainly intentional in the sense that his project is a scientific account of human nature, complete science of human nature. And science is itself a descriptive discipline. So when Newton formulates the laws of motion or the laws of gravity, these are descriptions of how physical objects behave. They aren't prescriptions. There's nothing normative about it. Newton's mm-hmm. laws don't tell us how things ought to go. Right. Just tells us how they do go. At least that would be the common understanding. And the same goes for Hume's analysis of human nature. In a sense, he's not all that interested in what humans ought to do or what humans ought to think. He's engaged in a project of explaining why we think the way we do and why we behave the way we do. So his epistemology, we can certainly talk about Hume's epistemology. He does have an epistemology in terms of what counts as knowledge, what counts as a rational belief, but it's far more a psychology of why we have the metaphysical beliefs that we do, why we have the moral beliefs that we do. So he's in a sense way ahead of his time, because as you guys probably know, there's a debate now in contemporary philosophy over whether epistemology, the whole discipline of epistemology, the theory of knowledge, should be naturalized so that it's no longer understood as a normative discipline of what we ought to believe or what counts as a rational belief, but more an account of what we do believe and a scientific account of how we come to the beliefs that we do.
Yeah.
That's a very modern debate. But that's something that Hume himself is doing at some level consciously and at some level not so explicitly. But yeah, in terms of his scientific account of things, it is more descriptive than it is prescriptive.
Mm-hmm. We're getting a very helpful perspective on Hume's way of thinking. How then, especially with a skeptical worldview, how does he ground morality? Where does morality come from? How do we determine right and wrong?
Hume is situated in a debate, an 18th century debate over the source of moral knowledge. And if you go back, of course, you have the Christian natural law tradition, which would have been really the mainstream view. Even Locke's views on ethics and justice are very Christian views in terms of their basic understanding of morality having come from God. But there are a number of alternative theories that are being developed and defended in Hume's time. One is the what's called the self-interest account, which associated in particular with Thomas Hobbes, where Hobbes argues that morality is basically driven by self-interest. So the reason we act as we do and the reason we say such and such is right is because it's in our interest to do that. And that was almost a scandalous view at that time, although there were some prominent defenders of it. Then there was the rationalist account, which argues that morality is based on reason. So we can rationally deduce the principles of morality. We can rationally deduce moral laws from other things that we know about human nature, about the nature of God. So Samuel Clarke was a prominent defender of the rationalist theory. And then thirdly, you have the moral sense views, which basically say that we can sense morality in the way that we sense other things like colors and shapes and so forth, that we have a faculty, a moral sense faculty, yeah, that allows us to observe certain actions that people do and certain character traits, and we can just see that they are good or bad, that
it's,
they are,
it's in the gut,
or vicious.
It's in the gut. Everyone knows that.
Yeah, it is almost instinctive, right? Yeah, you see someone beating up someone else, and you have a negative reaction to it.
Yeah, some might say that's the image of
God, right?
Exactly. Maybe that's the image of God. Maybe that's a conscience, or it could be your gut, just a naturalistic sense that we have.
Exactly. There's different accounts of what we would call our moral sensibilities. And the earlier moral sense theorists are explicitly Christian. They'll say, yeah, this right. is basically a faculty. Like God has given us a faculty to detect physical objects, to see colors, to see shapes and so forth. He's given us a faculty for mathematical intuitions, perhaps as well, logical intuitions. And we've got this faculty that gives us moral intuitions. But Hume, of course, being the consummate methodological naturalist, doesn't want to attribute this to God. Instead, he just wants to attribute it to natural faculties. And so just as we have a natural faculty for detecting colors and tastes, I mean, literal tastes, like the taste of
Indeed.
An orange or
right,
whatever.
Right.
So we have a faculty that just gives us moral reactions, moral feelings. It's a theory of sentimentalism in the sense that morality is based on sentiments, how we feel when we see people behave in certain ways.
Now, I know we don't have a ton of time to expand on everything. That's why it's really important that people pick up a copy of the book. But I do need to ask a question. You know, maybe I can bundle these together, but in terms of the basic features of Hume's argument against natural theology, but then he's quite well known for his argument against miracles. And perhaps you can tackle both of those, or at least introduce them to us so that you can whet people's appetite.
Sure. Yeah. I'll just say just enough to hook people, but I won't say too much so that they won't buy the book.
That's ever the salesman.
Yeah. Buy the first volume.
That's right.
Buy the first volume of this encyclopedia series. So you asked about the Critique of Natural Theology. Was that the first thing?
Sure. Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So Hume's famous work, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, takes on the whole project of natural theology. And what he does in it basically is he attacks the classical arguments for the existence of God, or at least the ones that were most popular in his day, which were a rationalistic version of the cosmological argument, particularly the version offered by Samuel Clarke, which is a fairly standard cosmological argument, the idea being that every event has a cause. There can't be an infinite chain of causes, so there has to be a first cause, and that first cause has to be an uncaused cause, and it has to be a necessarily existent being. And Hume attacks that on various grounds. His skepticism about causal principles comes into play, but also he thinks that the idea of a necessarily existent being is just bogus. That for any being we can conceive, we can consistently conceive of its non-existence. So to say that something must exist is an error of reasoning, Hume thinks. So he attacks these more rationalistic a priori arguments, arguments from pure reason, as it were. But really, a lot more of his firepower is directed at empirical arguments for the existence of God, particularly the design argument and those versions of the design argument that rely on analogical reasoning. So you look at things ordered in the natural world, you say, well, in our experience, when we find something, a complex thing that's ordered towards a certain end, like a watch or some other structure, we can infer that it must have had a designer. And so by analogy, if the universe as a whole has certain features, like the features of a human artifact, then we can infer that it must have had a designer as well. And Hume's basic critique of that is not that we should disregard the idea of a designer altogether, but that you will never have enough empirical evidence to justify the idea that there's a single transcendent, omnipotent, omniscient, all the omni attributes God, the God of classical theism. There are too many alternative hypotheses that could explain the same data. So one way to put it would be to say that, our empirical evidence underdetermines the claims that natural theology wants to make about there being a transcendent, omnipotent creator of the universe. So he tries to undermine the design argument as well. And then there's a section, actually a couple of sections, on the problem of evil, where he sort of turns the tables and says, well, if you want to have a natural theology that's based on what we can observe about the world, well, look how messed up the world is. There are things, some things that look like they're well-designed, right. Some things that look like they're badly designed.
Yeah.
There's all this suffering and evil. So if you're going to be a consistent natural theologian based on empiricism, then maybe you should posit the existence of God who's both good and evil, or who's incompetent in some respects, or this is where he eventually lands, is utterly indifferent to human pleasure and pain. And so he's trying to press the natural theologian into admitting that the conclusions that certainly an Orthodox Christian wants to make on the basis of natural theology go far beyond the empirical evidence. So that's his critique of natural theology. And then briefly, he has this famous argument against miracles as well, where really he has this axiom or maxim that a wise man proportions his belief to the evidence. A wise man proportions his belief to the evidence, what I call the evidentialist principle. And he argues that if we're just going on the basis of evidence, of empirical evidence, the evidence that we have against a miracle having occurred will always outweigh any evidence that we have in favor of it. So even if we've got some credible witness who says, I saw someone rise from the dead, I saw it with my own eyes, that counts for something. Hume doesn't dismiss testimony. He says, yeah, the testimony counts for something. But you always have to balance it against our entire past experience of regularity in nature. Everything in our own personal experience points to there being continuity rather than discontinuity in nature, of events following certain laws of nature. And so all of that counts against the miracle claim. So in the end, it's more rational, he argues, to think that the witness has been lying or has been deceived or is honestly mistaken in some way.
Sure.
That's always going to be where the balance of evidence should take us. And he has various other subsidiary arguments trying to undermine, again, the various testimonies that people have offered historically for miracle claims.
That's spectacular. That might be the best 5-minute synopsis on all that I've ever heard. So I'm going to clip that out, put that one on Facebook for sure. But listeners and viewers might be interested also, just from an historical perspective, to look at Hume and what he's doing in comparison to Joseph Butler. Bishop Butler, of course, a big English figure here in the argument from design. And the reason I mention that, it's Van Til deals quite a bit with Butler's analogy. And so if you'd like to dive down more into at least a Van Tilian approach into these matters and and situate Butler and Hume and Van Til together, that'd be well worth your time. So
yeah, that's fascinating to take those three thinkers and to sort of triangulate how they would criticize each other. It would be a very productive exercise.
Yeah, exactly. Now, of course, from my perspective, I think the argument from design fails just because of the empirical evidence in the existence of Mets fans, but I'll let a Mets fan, Jim, the fact that they exist, certainly no designer should have
that's
done
what
this.
They call gratuitous evil, right?
Yeah. Well, I do have a theology of the fall into sin, so I can, and the curse, so I can account for this. But Jim, I know, is interested to hear more specifically about the reform critiques. I'll let him ask.
I am almost certain that Yankee fans are evidence of an incompetent designer. I am persuaded. So moving from the mundane to the more profound, actually the question before we even get there, the question I'm dying to ask you, and actually it may be a wonderful segue question to get to the issue of a reformed critique of Hume's thought. So feel free to take it that way if that's where you want to go with it. But the question I'm dying to ask you is, what do you think of Hume's criticism of natural theology?
I think that it is sound in some respects and misguided in others. So a lot of his critique of natural theology is taking his epistemology for granted. So, for example, some of the criticisms he makes of the cosmological argument trace back to his, what is called Hume's fork, that you can only justify necessary claims if they are logically analytical. So the only necessary truths are analytical truths, or truths by definition, and the other kind of truths that you can justify would be matters of fact or contingent facts that can be empirically observed. So some of the criticisms that he makes of the cosmological argument in terms of, for example, the idea that every event must have a cause or an explanation, I think fail because they're taking a faulty epistemology for granted in the first place. I think his critique of the design argument is needs to be taken more seriously, because I think he is right that if you are approaching the design argument on a purely evidentialist basis, then the evidence does underdetermine what theology you're going to end up with.
Right.
And there needs to be certain a priori presuppositions, theological presuppositions, if you are going to rightly interpret the world. If you're just going to say, I'm not going to assume any theology in advance, I'm not going to assume any commitments to the idea of God or any metaphysical principles, and I'm just going to look at the observational evidence of the universe, I don't think that you can reason your way to the God of the Bible. I don't think that that's possible. But that doesn't mean that one can't come up with some more sophisticated design arguments, or can't incorporate evidences of design into a broader case, presuppositionalist case for the Christian faith. So if you're approaching the design argument on a purely evidentialist basis, then actually I find myself with Hume. I think he's right. I think his criticisms are devastating. But I think if you're starting with a broader presuppositionalist epistemology, then there is room for incorporating what is pervasive evidence of design in the universe into a more biblical epistemology.
Mm, that's a great way to put it, you know. And perhaps Van Til needs a little bit of he himself doesn't need to be kind of recovered, but a lot of people's interpretation of him. And Van Til was not opposed to evidences, but he would be opposed to looking at evidences on their own terms, apart from standing upon the foundation of Christian truth that God has revealed to us. So we read the design argument, or even the cosmological argument, the ontological argument. These arguments, you know, when you're reading them, you know, following them from Christian presuppositions, you know, I can read these arguments and say, of course, yeah, I believe there is a designer. Everybody does. We should. And I can believe in an unmoved mover and those sorts of things. But if you take the argument on strictly empirical terms, on an empirical foundation, a supposedly neutral position, they can't account for what they're trying to prove on their own terms. But that doesn't mean to say that they're completely useless or that the Christian rejects the conclusions of the arguments, just necessarily the foundational propositions and presuppositions.
It all comes back to the starting point. If you're trying to prove the existence of God on the basis of some neutral epistemology or some purely common sense epistemology, you know, there's a good kind of common sense I think we can incorporate into our epistemology. But in terms of a neutral common sense epistemology or empiricism or evidentialism, whatever it tries to be, I don't think you can start at that point and end up with a conclusion that's consistent with the biblical picture of God.
Well, the analogy you used in the book, if you have a certain type of fishing net, you're only going to catch certain types of fish. And so if you're beginning from a purely empirical standpoint, your method will never find or locate something that transcends those strictures. Yeah. And then you'll just end up in skepticism regarding anything that can't be demonstrated by your method. And that's exactly what Hume did. He couldn't even live with himself kind of day to day.
Yeah.
I admire him greatly for his rigor and for his consistency, but at the end of the day you see kind of the tragedy of the project as well.
Right. And that's why I say in the book that although Hume's project is a failure, it's a highly instructive failure.
Yeah.
Because it shows you what are the philosophical consequences of an epistemology and a worldview that excludes God from the outset, or at least tries to bracket out God. You know, Hume himself would say, I'm not denying God, but I'm certainly not going to assume God at the outset. But the Vantillian presuppositionalist argument is that was your first misstep, not even denying God, but failing to presuppose God in the first place. That is where you cut the ground out from under your own feet. And that's why you've ended up in a position of very radical skepticism.
Yeah. Wow. Well, James, this has been tremendous. I mean, when I was reading Van Til and coming across Hume, I very much appreciated also Van Til's approach, because it seemed that Van Til had an appreciation and an admiration for Hume, although, you know, a sober assessment as well, that he's coming from unbelieving presuppositions. And we have to wrestle with them. So that's where I think this book is tremendous, because it's an honest assessment, looking at Hume and looking at the difficult challenges that he proposes, but also doing it with sober judgment and I believe offering the hope of the gospel in a Reformed Christian position. So we've only scratched the surface. We only barely even mentioned Immanuel Kant, but I'll leave that to the readers, and perhaps we can have a round two sometime. But thanks so much, James, for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. It has been a pleasure.
Yeah, we look forward to talking more, and we always love speaking Reformed apologetics, and it's exciting. So people, check out the book. It's from PNR Publishing, David Hume and the Great Thinker series by our guest today, James Ann Anderson. Has a foreword by Andrew Hoffecker. I didn't mention that before, but we've spoken with him, and a tremendous scholar. And of course, thank you to Nate Shannon for editing the series. And we're looking forward to talking about more of these books in the future. Until then, you can visit us online at reformedforum.org. Find information about all of our programs and other things coming forward. Visit RTS online at rts.edu. Find out information about all of their campuses around the country, as well as their global education initiatives and different options that they have available there from you. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can get a hold of us through the contact page or by sending us an email at mail@reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.